The Siege of New Hampshire series by Mick Rowland. Book 6, The Summer of Wood and Iron. Chapter 5, The Grange Meeting. Nick lingered a couple of steps behind Martin as they climbed the stairs to the town hall's upstairs auditorium. "What gives?" Martin asked. "You've been dragging your feet all the way here. You look like a dog being taken to the vet."
"Or are they gonna make me drink goat's blood or something?"
Martin rolled his eyes. "Nick, it is not a cult. They have a Bible in the center of the room and quote Bible verses."
"But they make you wear that noose."
He pointed to the band of pale green fabric fastened loosely around Martin's neck and shoulders.
It's not a noose. It's more of a stole sash thing. And they don't make me wear it. It's just they like their ceremonial stuff. Each degree wears a different color. I think it's just a status thing, a way for upper degrees to show off their rank.
Yeah, well, dumb maybe, but no more cult-like than Boy Scouts showing off their merit badges. Now, come on. They didn't make me drink goat's blood. You won't either. When they entered the meeting room, the usual rows of chairs had been rearranged into a wide square, all facing inward. In the center of the square of chairs stood a pedestal with one of those huge old church Bibles on top. In the chairs along the far side of the square, along the front of the stage, sat a half dozen stern-faced old men and women, each wearing a wide silk sash like pageant winners wear. Their row of chairs was interrupted in the middle by a low podium. On it sat two chairs, each with an old man. The grayer and more hunched of the two wore a dark blue silk sash. He held a stout walking stick, maybe 5 feet tall, held in front of his knees as if to keep himself from toppling forward. Some people sat in chairs on the left. They were the second and third degrees. A few people sat on the right. The fourth degrees. Several people sat on chairs along the back wall, the visitor seating area. The tall windows were wide open, but there was little breeze. A few of the women fanned themselves with folded papers or booklets. Some of the sweatier men sat sprawled, as if to maximize evaporative area.
"These rows are for the first degrees and candidates," Martin whispered. "That's us."
"Do we have to sit up front?"
Nick whined quietly.
"If you would have walked faster, we would have gotten here early enough to sit in the back."
Martin and Nick slid into a pair of chairs in the front row. Charles, at the end of the front row, saw them and gave a little wave. People fidgeted and whispered while they waited for the meeting to begin. Martin became interested in whispered conversations behind him.
"So, what did you do?"
whispered one man.
"I told them they'd get birdshot in their butts if I caught them in my woods again," said a second. "Fools didn't think I'd hear them out there sawing."
"Did you recognize them?" asked the first man.
"No, but they had a wagon with them, so I figure they came from too far away to carry armloads. Sanford, maybe. They ran in that direction."
Two bass drum-like booms interrupted all conversations. It was the old man on the podium, using his staff to pound on the podium's hollow floor. The other old man rose solemnly.
"Good steward," he announced in a loud voice. "Close the gate that we may begin."
A man standing by the doors swung them shut.
"The fields are secure, overseer," he called back.
"If it please the master,"
began the standing man on the podium,
"I, the overseer, will conduct this meeting under your watch."
The seated old man nodded once and rapped his staff on the podium floor again.
"So moved and approved," said the standing man. "Let all hear and understand."
"Is all this really necessary?"
whispered Nick.
"Necessary? Oh, no,"
Martin whispered out of the side of his mouth. "It's old ceremonial stuff from when the Grange was a big deal, like back in the 1800s. These guys like it, though. Just think of it as a farmer's club with secret handshake stuff."
Steward? Overseer? Master? Nick said skeptically. And them all talking funny?
Okay, so 19th century secret handshake stuff. Just roll with it.
Nick's comment set Martin's wheels turning. What would qualify as really necessary? Even back in the easy times, people seemed to regularly indulge in things that did not strictly need to be done. Handshakes, singing happy birthday, Super Bowl parties. None of those sorts of things were truly necessary, yet people liked doing them. They had a social role.
The good chaplain will now open with the reading and the prayer, said the overseer from his podium.
A man in his late 50s, wearing faded overalls, approached the big Bible and stood with his hand on the open pages. Without looking down, he said,
He that will not plow by reason of the cold shall beg in the harvest and have nothing. He that tilleth his land shall be satisfied with bread. But he that followeth vain persons is void of understanding.
He bowed his head.
Dear Lord, bringer of the rains and provider who grows seed into our daily bread, bless this proceeding that it brings us all unity, charity, and wisdom. Amen.
As much as Martin accepted the old-fashioned ritual, he had sat through it enough times that his mind easily wandered. While the chaplain walked slowly back to his seat, Martin heard a different conversation behind him.
I saw some of them, too, said a woman in a soft hush. It was just before dawn, in our backwoods. At first I thought it was some deer heading for my apple trees. I went to chase them away, but when I got closer, I saw it was some of them.
A voice beside her gasped.
What did you do? She asked breathlessly. I didn't know what to do. We saw each other and just stood there and looked at each other for a minute. Oh, luckily for me, they turned away, back deeper into the woods. Oh, you're really lucky they ran away, said the breathless woman. I've heard they sometimes charge at people who are alone. Oh, I know. I shouldn't have gone out alone like that. Alice said that they feed on poison ivy, so that their saliva is toxic. One bite from them could kill you. Oh, I've heard that too, said Breathless. I told Raymond about them. He took his gun and went out looking for them once it was lighter out. He found them in that hollow, down by that little pond near the back of our property. They were bedded down between a couple of old fallen trees. They must have heard him, he said, because they were up and ran before he got close. He chased them, but his knees aren't so good anymore. He shot at them, but he didn't think he got any of them. Oh, my, it's getting so a body can't even leave their homes anymore.
Before we hear our reports, said the overseer, we must first open our gate to any worthy candidates. Are there steadfast men and women in the field who wish to join us in the fellowship of the plow?
A woman in the middle row stood up, as did a man at the left end of the row. Martin nudged Nick and whispered,
This is it. Stand up. Which Bible verse did you pick?
Nick stood nervously.
I didn't pick one yet.
Well, they're going to ask you for one. They won't let you cheap out either with Jesus Wept or John 3:16. Where's that paper I gave you?
In my pocket.
Well, that's not going to do you any...
Step forth, candidates,
called the overseer. He stood beside the Bible on the pedestal. Nick swallowed hard and dawdled long enough to be third in line. Martin could see him discreetly push his hand into his pocket and slowly draw out the paper. He snuck peeks at it while the first two recited their verses and took the oath. The overseer leveled a stare at Nick when it was his turn.
Candidate,
he said in a slow, almost accusing tone.
The work of bringing forth food from the land requires men of strong moral character and his word in their hearts.
He thrust a finger toward the ceiling, then pointed it at Nick.
What word have you to say?
Martin could see the paper rolled up in Nick's hand.
For by grace are ye, be ye saved through, faith, and not by yourself, of yourself. It is a gift of God, not of works.
He held his breath and winced. Martin hoped that that was close enough to qualify. Apparently it was, as the overseer moved on to the oath. Nick blew out the breath he had been holding.
Do you solemnly swear to aid your brothers and sisters of the plow whenever they shall be in need?
I do, Nick glanced at Martin, seeking reassurance with his eyes.
The overseer turned to face the people sitting in front of the stage.
These candidates have taken the oath and bear the word. Do you deem them worthy?
The old people wearing the sashes all gave one slow nod.
Then I hereby call these our brothers and sisters. Sister Amy, bestow upon these good workers the mark of their degree.
A slender woman, with her salt and pepper hair pulled back in a bun, draped a pale green circle of fabric around each new member's shoulders. The other two candidates returned to their seats, collecting handshakes and fist bumps along the way. Nick returned to his seat, fingering his green band. He slumped into his seat and let out a long sigh.
Whew, glad that's over.
Charles walked over and shook Dick's hand.
Hey, welcome to the club, brother, he winked.
He sat in the empty chair beside Martin. He leaned forward to talk past Martin in a semi-whisper.
Don't let all the ceremony stuff get to you, Nick. They're really a good bunch. Lots of helping each other out.
Martin saw an impish twinkle in Charles's eye.
Just don't let them talk you into joining their secret circle of the Black Heart.
He spoke with the drama of telling a ghost story.
They bring out a cup made from a skull, and you have to drink.
Oh, stop it, Martin bumped Charles with his elbow. There is no Circle of the Black Heart, Nick. He's making that up to scare you.
Shh, we need to be quiet now.
They're giving reports. A barrel-chested man with a round face stepped onto the podium. He gave a report on the hay crop around town. Good rain during the first part of summer had resulted in a decent first cutting. The second cutting might not be so good. To ensure that there was enough hay laid up for the town's animals for winter, every bit of the first crop needed to be harvested. There were still fields that needed cut. He asked if any members had hay fields that needed help cutting, raking, or gathering. A few hands went up. Barrel Chest asked for volunteers to see those people after the meeting and arrange for work days. A second speaker, this one with a decidedly square jaw and stooped posture, took the podium. He spoke of a shortage of fertilizer. Whatever people had in storage from before the stores closed was all but gone. Folks with livestock had been keeping their manure for their own fields. He reported that the city of Manchester was looking for farmers who would accept loads of sewage sludge to use as fertilizer. No one's hand went up. He recited statistics about the nutrient content and how it was safe for crops, well, other than root crops. He repeated assurances that he had heard about how it might not smell too bad after some oxidization and sunlight. Were there any takers? Still no hands went up. Stooped man shrugged and shuffled back to his seat. Martin wondered what Andy's humanure would be like next spring. Would it stink? Should he use it for the fruit trees, the corn and tomatoes, but not in soil where carrots, beets, or onions would go? The overseer introduced their lecture for the meeting. Martin thought it a little odd that he only cited the topic, not the speaker's name. A man stood up from the back row, left side. It was Clyde Gradick. Little wonder his name had not been mentioned. Martin could see eyes in the audience narrowing. He heard grumbles and mutterings. Hard feelings had not softened much over the months since Clyde blackmailed his way into power. His inglorious fall had not, apparently, been sufficient penance to satisfy many of the townsfolk. Clyde could hear the murmurings as he walked up to the podium. He scowled at his audience. Martin saw that Clyde wore the sand-colored band of a third degree. This lecture was probably part of the requirements to advance to the fourth degree. That seemed to explain why Clyde was bothering to give a lecture to an unfriendly crowd. From what Martin knew of Clyde's pride, it came as no surprise that he was trying to quickly advance in rank. Perhaps he had designs on becoming overseer and eventually master of the Cheshire Grange. While that seemed like the big frog in a small pond, at least he was working his way up instead of staging some sort of blackmail or a coup. Clyde's talk recounted how our modern corn was domesticated from a wild grass species that grew in the tropics of Central America. He said that explained why corn was a thirsty plant, requiring warmth, sun, and a great deal of water in order to thrive and produce well. Corn is a heavy feeder, too, taking more nitrogen from the soil than other crops. He detailed the life cycle and common pests to watch out for. When he concluded his lecture, he asked if there were any questions. A stifling silence filled the room. Martin thought that such festering grudges weren't good for the town, so he decided to break the very thick ice. He raised his hand. The fact that someone in his hostile audience had a question seemed to startle Clyde. His scowl drooped into a stuporous stare. He blinked at Martin for a moment or two, trying to process the impossible, before calling on him.
Ah, you have a question?
His tone betrayed some disbelief. Martin stood. Yes, first off, thank you for that informative lecture. Martin didn't know Clyde all that well, but he did know that a little ego-stroking would soften his mood. You mentioned that corn requires a lot of nitrogen in the soil, but we just heard about a shortage of fertilizers, commercial fertilizer anyway, and we heard how manure isn't easy to come by anymore. Do you have any suggestions for how we should fertilize our corn now?
That's a good question.
Some of Clyde's swagger returned. He cited the use of urine as a common third-world source of nitrogen. Diluted 8 or 10 to 1, it could be applied regularly without damaging the plants. Martin saw a few people around him wrinkle their noses slightly at the thought of handling their own urine instead of flushing it away. He wondered how much more their noses would wrinkle if, or rather when, they had to clear out their septic tanks. The social ice having been broken, Clyde fielded other questions about how to know when field corn was ripe, how to prevent borers, and the importance of drying harvested corn. Martin leaned over to Nick. After the meeting, you should ask Clyde to come by your place and look at your corn, give you some tips.
Why would he do that? I heard he's mad at everyone. It doesn't know me from Adam.
True on both points, but actually, he needs you.
He needs me?
Yep. You see, I think he's trying to move up from third degree to fourth degree. And one of the requirements for a fourth degree is to give a lecture, and he just did that. And to help a fellow member in need with his crops. Kind of like a merit badge thing. I can't picture folks ever asking Clyde for help. But you ought to ask him before someone else gets up the courage to do so. He only needs to help one member. Make it you.
Oh, you know him, said Nick. Introduce me, then I'll ask.
Oh, no, no, no. He knows me and probably will think I'm up to something. Better if you, as Mr. Random Citizen, ask him. Do it right after the meeting. Oh, we'll talk later. Jeff is going to speak next. A hush fell over the room as the overseer introduced Landers. He walked up beside the Bible pedestal. Landers gave a grim rendition of the water impoundment disputes popping up around town. Before he could describe his Solomonic compromise, Someone on the left raised his voice, asserting that what he did on his property was none of anyone's business. A man two rows back from Martin stood up, exclaiming that stream water was not his exclusive property. That prompted a woman on the right to stand, fists on hips, stating that any water on her land was hers. Others also stood, objecting loudly about losing their water sources. The overseer's gavel and the master's pounding walking stick were lost in all of the shouting. 19th-century ritual was no match for an argument over water rights. People were starting to leave their chairs in order to get into the faces of their opponents. A loud, shrill whistle split the chaos. Everyone stopped shouting and faced the stage. One of the silk-sash elders, a short woman with white hair, stood with two fingers still in her mouth.
"Sit down and shut up!" she shouted.
It was a lot of voice from such a small package.
"Mr. Landers is trying to talk!"
She stayed standing, casting a withering stare at the few who did not sit down quickly. Once the audience was seated and quiet, she sat down slowly. Her face morphed from an angry scowl to a peaceful Sunday in church face, as if the whole incident had never happened.
"Mrs. Keeler was my third-grade teacher," whispered someone to Martin's right. "Me too," whispered another. "She hasn't changed a bit."
Thank you, Mrs. Keeler," said Landers. "As you all see, this is a thorny issue. Do we want what had just happened here to be what the whole town becomes? How is everyone going to be preparing for winter if they're busy fighting with their neighbors?"
Some people hung their heads. Others, with lingering scowls, looked around. Their frowns faded. Landers outlined his proposed warrant article for the upcoming town meeting. The impounders would get to keep their ponds, but those downstream would be assured of a reasonable flow. The town would be empowered to police the matter and keep things fair. He held up a clipboard with sheets of lined paper. He expressed confidence that a petition signed by many Grange members, people on both sides of the issue, would be persuasive to the citizens when it came time to vote on the warrant article. Martin could see many heads subtly nodding.
"And with your Grange master's kind indulgence,"
Landers turned to face the old man with the walking stick,
"I would like to introduce Mr. Clive Farnham, a man from up north, who asked to address the members of the Grange. He and I have spoken at some length about the state of our communities and making a better future for us all. Mr. Farnham."
Landers held his arm out, pointing to a visitor seated along the back wall. A middle-aged man arose and strode toward the Bible pedestal. He was taller than average and lacking the emaciated look that had become so commonplace. He wore a dark blue sport coat, which struck Martin as odd for such warm weather. Despite glistens of sweat at his receding hairline, Mr. Farnham's expression was determined, or resolute, rather than the more customary sag from feeling hot that most people wore.
"Thank you, worthy Grange Master, for your kind indulgence,"
Mr. Farnham gave a little bow toward the podium.
"Good citizens of Cheshire, and distinguished members of this Grange Society, I come before you today to outline a proposal. A proposal to solve a problem."
He paused for dramatic effect, slowly panning his gaze across the room.
"I need not recount to you the predicament we have all found ourselves in these past 9 months. While the cause of the failure of our power grid has remained a mystery, the ramifications are no mystery at all. Without the grid, the powerful wheels of American economy have ground to a halt. Through the, and may I say, misguided decisions at the federal level, the great state of New Hampshire has been cut off from all aid and assistance."
"Why is he telling us what everyone knows?" whispered Nick out of the side of his mouth. Shh, he's just building up to something, Martin whispered back. Let's wait for the something.
Farnham's tone and volume increased.
Those misguided decision-makers may have thought that the residents of this great state would, out of want and desperation, cry out and welcome whatever shackles and chains their would-be overlords deigned, in exchange for a crust of bread.
While Martin thought Farnham's rhetoric was a bit florid, several heads in the audience began to nod. Florid or not, Farnham seemed to know how to work a room.
But you, the inheritors of that sturdy Yankee spirit, refuse to bend the knee, refuse to cry out. Instead, you banded together to share, improvise, and survive a brutal winter. That you have done, and for that are to be praised for your success.
Farnham looked across the crowd, nodding slightly as he paused again.
But that success has reached its limitation. Neighbors helping neighbors suffice for mere survival, but it has no potential for growth. Even one village trading with another hits that limitation too. What New Hampshire needs is a grand barter, an exchange of goods on a scale that no neighborhood or village could attain, an exchange of goods across scores of miles, not just across your town line.
Isn't that what we are doing with our trips to the coast? Whispered Charles.
Our state needs a strong backbone of trade upon which many branches of commerce can grow. These branches can, and I believe will, reach far and wide into nearly every community in this state.
Farnham pounded his fist on the Bible.
I am here today, ladies and gentlemen, to announce to you the dawn of that strong economic backbone, the Central Rail Collaborative.
He paused again for effect.
The CRC will utilize wood-burning steam locomotives, a power source our oppressors cannot control. With this power and the rail corridor running up the middle of the state from Nashua up to Lincoln, the CRC will carry goods and passengers up and down the center of this great state. The core of this economic backbone will be wood. I have toured many towns here in the southern tier, and I can see that there is an outright shortage of wood in some communities. Fuel for cooking and fuel for winter.
Oh, Cheshire has plenty of wood, Martin muttered, but apparently not as softly as he thought.
That may be true,
boomed Farnham, pointing a finger directly at Martin, who jumped in his seat. After a moment, Farnham's gaze resumed panning across the audience.
But others are not so well blessed. Other communities have drawn heavily upon their limited wood supplies in order to survive the past winter. They are in depleted condition to survive the next. What many southern tier towns need is abundant firewood. The North Country has the wood, but little farmland. The southern tier has the farmland, but not the wood.
Cheshire folks might have the wood, whispered Charles quietly, but we can't hardly pry any of it out of them.
They're just saving it for themselves, Martin whispered back. Farnham continued.
The CRC offers you, farmers in the south, the golden opportunity to trade your surplus crops with woodsmen of the north. You need their wood, they need your food.
"And what if we don't need the North Country's wood?"
asked a man on the left.
"An excellent question, my good man," said Farnham. "Perhaps you are so well blessed that you do not need more wood for your personal consumption. But firewood is a valuable commodity. Others around you will need it and will be willing to trade handsomely for it. This, my friends, is how the CRC will function as the foundation of a revitalized New Hampshire economy. A thriving economy requires inputs. We cannot simply trade back and forth a finite supply of goods."
Martin thought for a moment about how accurately Farnham's last statement fit Cheshire. Their weekly market sessions were vigorous at first. People traded back and forth what surpluses they had on hand when the power went out. Consumption of things like factory food reduced tradable stocks. People's need for durable goods eventually leveled out. Those who needed boots acquired them and didn't need to trade for more. By spring, the trading sessions had dwindled to a pair of tables and lasted only 15 minutes.
"I repeat," said Farnham, with a finger pointed skyward for emphasis, "what a vibrant economy needs is a regular infusion of inputs, new goods that people need. Food and fuel, my friends, are what the people of New Hampshire need. The Central Rail Collaborative is poised to facilitate the trade of food and fuel on a scale that no single community can muster. Upon this economic core will flourish a host of other trading opportunities. Goods will flow, lives will be improved. New Hampshire can be poised to weather this coming winter in better shape. Think of it, my friends. Less hardship, less death. More health, more comfort. My cause today, the reason I stand before you now, is to encourage you to grow more crops than you feel you will need for the winter. Grow whatever you can. Wherever you can, I encourage you to produce a surplus of both food and fodder. Bring your produce to our new rail terminal in Manchester. Trade your goods for firewood from the north. Be part of New Hampshire's new economy. I thank you."
Farnham bowed deeply, then returned to his seat. A soft din of murmurs arose. People in the audience turned to each other in quiet conversations. Reading the faces, Martin saw more curiosity, musings, or smiles than he did frowns. There were a few frowns, but then there always seemed to be a few, regardless of the news. The overseer began his closing monologue about going forth and making the land bear much fruit. The steward opened the double doors. The master rapped his walking stick on the podium floor twice. The meeting was adjourned. Everyone stood up. Murmured conversations burst up into full volume.
"I'm not sure where else I could grow any extra crops," said Nick. "I'm on a 1-acre house lot, surrounded by swamp."
"Well, there might be some options," said Martin. "But right now, you need to get over there and introduce yourself to Clyde and ask for help." Nick's eyes grew wide as he saw Clyde sneaking around the back of the standing crowd and headed for the doors. Nick set off on an intercept course.
"Ah, Simmons," said Landers. "Yeah, you got a minute? You too, Charles."
Sure. Martin saw Landers had Mr. Farnham in tow.
"I was telling Mr. Farnham about you boys' new generator welder machine. He asked if he could speak with you, so I said I'd make some introductions. Mr. Farnham, this here is Charles Hendrick and Martin Simmons. They are the lads I told you about."
"It is a pleasure to meet you."
Farnham shook both Martin and Charles's hands with an overvigorous car salesman's handshake.
"I should like very much to see this wondrous machine of yours. If it is anything like your Mr. Landers has told me, the CRC could be an opportunity for you.
If you're a Siege Story listener living outside of the U.S., and there are quite a few of you, you might be wondering what all that Grange meeting stuff was about. Well, heck, even if you were born and raised in the U.S., you could easily still not know what the Grange was. The short answer is that the Grange was a fraternal organization created in the U.S. in the late 1860s to support farmers and promote farming. The founders modeled their order of the Patrons of Husbandry, the Grange for short, loosely after the Masonic pattern, but with a mix of Greek mythology and Christianity. Many, many rural towns across America had Grange chapters. Many small towns still have Grange halls. The Grange came about to fill a need. The middle to late 1800s was a time when farming was transitioning from a man-and-muscle job to more of a mechanized industry. For instance, a farmer with one of McCormick's fancy new horse-drawn mower reapers could harvest 10 times as much acreage as a man with a cradle scythe. Farmers of small farms benefited from having a support group to help them improve their yields and lobby for their interests. That latter part, the lobbying, helps explain some of the convoluted ceremonial stuff that seems really strange to us nowadays. Back in the late 1800s, the Grange lobbied for lower freight costs to ship grain via railroad. The railroad companies wanted higher freight costs, of course. So they would send spies out to infiltrate Grange meetings to find out what sort of pending legislation the Grange was going to promote. That was one of the original practical reasons for the role of the gatekeeper, the secret handshakes, the passwords, and the ceremonial exchanges. They were a way to expose a non-member spy. Of course, some secret handshake stuff is just a little bit fun anyhow. Back in the 1800s, it seemed like people were more fond of ceremony than folks nowadays have patience for. Maybe it was a liturgical feel, something formal and therefore respectable. Modern life in the 21st century seems almost devoid of ceremony. Most things are bare bones and matter of fact. Reading how Grange meetings were conducted back then sounds really odd to the modern ear. But on a practical level, with local residents gathering regularly, Grange meetings became a focus for small-town social life. With group singing, poetry reading, lectures, and other entertainment, in addition to talking about crops and other farming business. In a world without email, Facebook, and video chats, Grange meetings were a popular social mixer, where neighbors could chat and share gossip. It was a place for singles to meet, too. All that kind of faded away as the 20th century wore on. Automobiles, telephones, and later the internet would provide other ways to socialize. Farming became such a big business that very few people actually farmed anymore. Grange membership dwindled to very low numbers. Local chapters still exist, but have become more of a civic group than a farming group. As I worked on the story for Book 6, it seemed like the original reasons for the Grange would return. A bunch of newbie, small-time farmers would need a support group. And as well, with the grid down, our usual social mixer outlets like Facebook and social media would be gone. Local meetings would be appealing again. Plot-wise, a gathering like the Grange meeting would be a realistic reason for Mr. Farnham, from far north in the mountains, to be pitching his railroad project 100 miles away and get Charles and Martin involved. In podcast news, a look at the stats showed that the Siege Stories had over 100 downloads in Romania. What's up with that? Canada, the UK, Ireland, Australia, and New Zealand seem logical enough, being English-speaking countries, and there are dozens in the Netherlands, Germany, France, and Belgium, and a smattering of most other European countries. It's kind of humbling to see how far the Siege Story has reached. Thank you for being one of the listeners. And a heartfelt thanks to those of you who bought some virtual coffees at Buy Me a Coffee or became monthly members. I do appreciate it. Talk to you next week.